A. Feuer versus Merck. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Lisa Rodriguez representing the appellant R. A. Feuer.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gordon Cooney representing the appellee Merck and Company Incorporated.
Welcome to all counsel, Ms. Rodriguez. Please go ahead.
Your Honor, before I begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Good morning, Your Honors. The issue before the court today is a straightforward one. What is the scope of the right of a shareholder who has shown a proper purpose to inspect the corporate records of a corporation under the New Jersey Books and Records Statute and under the common law? Let's first talk about what Section 4, which is the relevant section for today's purposes, let's talk about what it is not. It is not wealth-based. It gives the court discretion first to determine whether or not a shareholder has a proper purpose for the documents it seeks, and if it so determines, then it gives the court discretion to determine what documents the shareholder is entitled to. Merck reminds us repeatedly throughout its brief that Mr. Feuer owns 288 shares of Merck stock. That fact should be of no import to this court in deciding the relevant scope of the Books and Records Statute. Under Section 4, it is the shareholder's proper purpose and not the size of his portfolio that gives him access to the corporate records that he seeks. Once a proper purpose has been shown, the statute should be read broadly and liberally to enable the court to give discretion to get those documents that satisfy the shareholder's proper purpose. This is consistent with both the common law and the law of other jurisdictions, including Delaware, to which this court often looks for support. Alternatively, if the court determines to read the term books and records of account narrowly, the second sentence of Section 4 of the statute provides sufficient discretion to the court to allow it to grant the relief that allows a shareholder to get the relevant documents that it seeks. This outcome is in line with the language of the statute, and it allows the court to balance the rights of the minority shareholder with the rights of the corporation. I'm here today to urge this court to adopt a common sense approach interpretation of the statute, one that allows the court the necessary discretion to compel documents that address the very reason that the documents are being sought. I know the court is familiar with the facts, and I will not belabor them other than to set forth a brief timeline. Mr. Feuer, after the announcement of an acquisition of Cubis, sent four demands to Merck, asking them to reconsider the acquisition of Cubist, and to take corporate responsibility for the loss of the drop in shares caused by the acquisition. The last demand was for books and records of the corporation. This demand was sent to the corporation consistent with this court's holding in PSE&G and the documents that the court determined were appropriate under the modified business judgment rule. Merck refused the requested documents. Mr. Feuer then instituted a books and records complaint. The trial court found that Mr. Feuer had a proper purpose for the documents he sought, but simply that the statute was not broad enough to allow the court to compel those very documents. Accordingly, the court granted defendant's motion to dismiss. Merck has never challenged the trial court's finding of proper purpose, and neither the trial court nor the appellate division ever made a determination that the documents that Mr. Feuer sought were not consistent with the proper purpose. Only that under a narrow reading of the statute, those documents were not available to him. The last time a New Jersey court has considered Section 4 of the Books and Records Statute was in the Appellate Division case of Kane versus Merck. There, the court acknowledged a continued common law power of inspection. The Kane court recognized the impact on the corporation, the impact that a request for inspection could have on the corporation, and the need for the court to balance the rights of a minority shareholder with the impact on the corporation. Here, the impact of the lower court's opinion to divest the court of the discretion to balance these interests when determining whether to grant certification creates a situation where the court can compel documents that simply aren't relevant to the documents that the shareholder needs to prevent to prove or consistent with their proper purpose.
Ms. Rodriguez, and follow up the last statement you made, the purpose of Mr. Fuhrer is to obtain documents in order to file derivative action. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, under 14A368, individual seeking to file derivative actions entitled to some discovery based on the number of shares or the amount of the shares, some kind of security must be posted. Under your interpretation of this statute, wouldn't that swallow that the entire derivative action, course of actions? No one would ever, regardless of the size of shareholders, be required to post because they'd go do an end run on 36.8. Isn't that basically the problem here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think, and I know that Merck has argued that, and the Appellate Division found that that was compelling, but I think you need to look at what happens. PSE&G acknowledges some limited shareholder discovery on the issue of whether or not the demand was wrongfully refused based on good faith and the amount of time that the special committee was looking at the issue. And here, to give the shareholder that early discovery, which the Books and Records Statute is entitled to, allows that shareholder to do one of two things. If the information shows that, in fact, the corporation acted in good faith and due diligence in denying the demand, it may totally obviate the need for
the derivative action.
But it's
limited discovery, books and accounts, but as I read the request for documents, the document demand is rather extensive. And I guess it comes down to the interpretation of books and accounts by this court, but it seems rather extensive. So wouldn't it more properly be under the 14A3-6.8 with some type of security posted because of the number of shares Mr. Fuhrer holds?
And I'm saying, Your Honor, I don't think we get to that point. I think if you allow certain limited discovery under the Books and Records Statute, the shareholder can then decide whether or not to bring a derivative action, and it may be that he decides he doesn't have a sufficient basis. Or if he does, he can plead a more robust derivative complaint, and at that point, if he owns less than 5% of the shares or less than $250,000, he still needs to post a bond. Once he pursues his derivative case,
right. But under this Section 4, it's very limited discovery. It's subject to books and accounts. And I've looked at your demand for document demand. It's approximately 12 sections that are rather expansive, are they not?
They are expansive, Your Honor. We've never gotten to the point where when we served the demand back in December of 2016, right. I think it was, we offered to sit down and meet and try to resolve the issue of if, to the extent Merck thought it was overbroad, but we never even got to that point.
So help us if you could with the words of the statute. It provides for the production of books and records of account, as you have pointed out to us. What does that mean? What meaning, as you read the statute, does the phrase of account have here? Because it's not corporate documents generally. Tell us what it is.
Well, I know, Your Honor, and it's been pointed out to us what the Black's Law Dictionary is of books and account, books and records of account, and that typically includes accounting documents and financial records. And I concede that the dictionary definition of books and account is a narrow one. Other courts have expanded the definition so that it makes sense in the context of the request. But even if the court is determined to say books and records of account limits you to the financial and accounting documents of the corporation, I think the next sentence of the statute that says the court may in its discretion prescribe any limitations or conditions with reference to the inspection or award any other further relief as the court may deem just and proper. And I know both the appellate division and Merck itself has read that as two limiting provisions, making the corporation the subject of that subsection 4. But it's not the corporation, it's the shareholder. So it may restrict what the shareholder is entitled to, or it may award any other relief. And under the same Black's Law Dictionary, award means to grant by formal process or judicial decree. So the court can expand that, and it makes sense in context of the statute, because if you say a shareholder with a proper purpose is entitled to documents, and then you say, but your documents are limited to books and records of account, minutes, and shareholder records, it's nonsensical when those documents do nothing to address the proper purpose that the court also has the ability and discretion to determine.
So if we read the phrase that you highlighted, any other or further relief broadly, does it swallow the rest of the statute?
I don't believe that it does. I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think that corporate books and records of account, initially I would argue that should be read broadly. It should be read broadly, not to just incorporate financial and accounting documents. And many other courts have, even with books and records of account, have determined that term should be used broadly. So I think that initially, I think that is broad enough to incorporate the documents that we seek. But I think that then you do have discretion, and the discretion is, you go back, you have the discretion to determine there's a proper purpose. So if you've made that inquiry, if you've made the inquiry that the proper purpose is to determine whether or not the board adequately considered issues before it, then it only makes sense that you have the discretion to give them the documents that they need.
But can I make a suggestion that perhaps the legislature didn't mean for that second sentence that you're focused on now, Ms. Rodriguez, to be an expansive additional grant of power? Because when you look at the legislative history and the refinements that were being made in 1988 to the Corporation Business Act, those additional sentences in subsection 4 were being put in place on the recommendation of the Corporation Revision Commission to further clarify and contain the obligation to submit, to produce records on behalf of shareholder requests. I don't see anything in that legislative history that those additional sentences were opening up further what was viewed in the first sentence as conditioned on a proper purpose, an otherwise absolute right to the very specific documents that are being obliged to be kept in subsection 1. And yet you're giving it an entirely different interpretation now.
Well, I think you need to look at the word award, and I think award needs to mean something. It doesn't make sense in the context of the statute to say, I mean, if they wanted to just limit it to the court may in its discretion prescribe any limitations or conditions with reference to the inspection, period.
That could very well mean the procedural aspects or where it was going to be produced or where it had to be, in what manner it would be produced. You're reading it as a substantive additional grant of authority. And yet your complaint also has a count in the common law, which fits the kind of argument that you're making, not here from the words of the statute, I would suggest.
Well, and I think, Your Honor, that looking at Cain v. Merck, the court there, the appellate division there, urged that the statute was a continuation of the common law.
It certainly allows for the continuation of the common law. That's part of your argument, and I see that argument. But it doesn't mean that it was codifying for all time the limitations of the common law.
But I think, Your Honor, to make a determination early on that there has to be a proper purpose, it then makes no sense to have the documents, and that's a very...
In the legislative history from 1988, there was a concern about demands for shareholder lists that would be resold on the market for improper purposes. There was clearly a contemplation by the legislature about improper purposes for the things that were being identified in subsection 1 as automatically being matters that any shareholder could request and receive. So there is a logic here that fits not and is not consistent with the one that you're urging for the court.
Well, I think, again, it goes back to that argument makes sense with regard to shareholder lists, but the statute itself does not define what proper purpose is.
Well, how about forget proper purpose? Isn't it limited to the specific items that are subject to inspection? And then, right before or award, if we're just looking at this textually, limits or conditions with reference to the inspection. The inspection, it would seem, would be to the very items that are listed in the previous, in the same sentence, or the previous sentence. Books and records of account, minutes and records, what else would be inspected?
Right.
Reference to the inspection, and then or award any other. What does the word reference to the inspection mean? Inspection of what? I'm looking at section 4. Right before or award.
The court may, in its discretion, prescribe any conditions or limitations with reference to the inspection.
And the inspection is what is listed in the previous sentence.
And also in section 1 as to what the corporation shall keep, books and records of account and minutes of the proceedings of its shareholders and executive and board committee. I mean, there's a logic between these sections that doesn't require the expansive reading that you're urging the court to give to the second sentence of 4.
I think, Your Honor, you have to look at, this is a statute that's, the lack of judicial opinion on the statute is not one, underscores the fact that this is not something that is a common occurrence. And part of the fear that Merck talks about and the appellate division talked about was the huge abuse of power that a statute like this could have if it was read expansively. But I think that has not proven itself. And I do think that there's alternative interpretations of this statute. And you have to look at the purpose of even allowing records.
So what I'm trying to understand is why did the legislature do what it did in passing this particular provision and limiting the items to be inspected if it were not supplanting the common law? Because the common law permitted much more expansive inspection of documents, and the legislature now passes an enactment that seems to limit the types of documents that are subject to inspection.
Or, Your Honor, perhaps the of account was just superfluous and they meant not to restrict the common law. Because the rest of the language, like the proper purpose, is equivalent to germane purpose, good faith.
The proper purpose is limited to a proper purpose for getting these books and records of account, minutes and record of shareholders of a corporation. If you don't have a proper purpose for that, then you're nowhere. Right?
If you don't have a proper purpose for
Upon proof by a shareholder of a proper purpose, and then it goes on. You can compel a production for examination of such shareholder of the books and records of account, minutes, the rest of what it says.
I think it can be read alternatively. I think it can be read that you can, upon proof of a proper purpose, you have the right to inspection of books and records of accounts, minutes, and record of shareholder. And books and books and records of account, I mean, that's the issue, whether or not the legislature intended to mean of account to totally restrict and change the common law. It was an amendment from the earlier version of the statute that talked about simply transfer records and something else. So this was, the intent was to make it more expansive from the prior legislation. The issue was whether the inclusion of the term of account meant to totally restrict and do something other than the common law, and I don't think that there's
enough. So if it doesn't do that, tell us what it means. Tell us, in your view, what those words mean, and what class of documents are therefore subject to inspection.
Well, I think you look at the records, the correspondence, reports that were made in this instance to the special committee. I think all those things fall within the definition of other jurisdictions' books and records definition.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you, I don't mean to cut you off. In responding, tell me what you think it limits. Like, what would be off limits given your definition?
I think that this, because it talks twice about the court's discretion, to determine whether the purpose is proper. So if the purpose to make a determination of whether or not the company just looked at what it should have done, if that was not going to entitle you to documents, then the court shouldn't have found that he had a proper purpose.
So it limits nothing under your interpretation?
No, I think it's incumbent upon the court. The court
says, I'm going to ask you, because as I understand your response, under your interpretation, it limits nothing. Everything's available. So why is it there if it limits nothing?
I think there are many other jurisdictions that have books and records statutes that use the term books and records, and it's a constant, pushing
of account.
About what
you're leaving those two words out, of account, books and records of account, as opposed to other jurisdictions.
But I start with, Your Honor, books and the of account is superfluous, and I don't think that given the legislative history, you can make a determination that the legislature intended to change the common law by simply adding of account.
Actually, you want us to say it's superfluous? What basis do we have to say, oh, those words mean nothing, they're superfluous? How could we come to that conclusion?
I think if you look at the purpose of the statute, again, if you have a determination of proper purpose, again, if you're going to limit the...
Isn't one of our most common canons of statutory interpretation is to give effect to every word of a statute so that no word is deemed superfluous? Am I mistaken about that?
No, Your Honor. And that was my argument with regard to the word award. I think that is not superfluous either, and that shows that the court has discretion. But
I'm sorry, go ahead, finish your answer, please.
I think of account is it's not a defined term. And so what the legislature meant, I don't think that you can by the same token that you can use those two words to make the conclusion that it was the legislature's determination to limit the common law rights to what you were entitled to. And particularly when you go back and you look at the requirement and the discretion of the court to determine proper purpose. Because if the court finds there's a proper purpose, then it makes no sense to limit to these narrow categories without saying proper purpose can only be something that's satisfied by these three categories. But otherwise, you don't have a proper purpose.
If you look, however, at the history of shareholders' derivative actions, and which is obviously they're more diverse today than they ever were, I would say is a fair statement. There are more reasons why people bring them, more different theories that people bring them. But historically, isn't it fair to say they really were about primarily accounting issues? They were about balance sheets that were fraudulent and about people falsifying their assets and not telling shareholders financial aspects of it. So doesn't it make sense to see those words, books of account, as the legislature's effort to address the most prevalent form of shareholders' derivative action, which was very financially based? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
I mean, it's not like account has nothing to do with a proper purpose for a shareholders' derivative action. If you look at it, especially when the statute went into effect, that was really going to the heart of a shareholders of a proper purpose. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes.
So wouldn't it make sense that the legislature was trying to open up specifically preserve the ability to get at those financial documents as a way of addressing what it may have been aware was the most common type of shareholders' derivative action?
That may be, Your Honor, but I also think that this section itself is concerned with balancing of a minority shareholder's rights. A minority shareholder has rights, and those rights have to be balanced against the corporation.
Right.
And that's why when you go and you look at the common law, when it talks about germane purpose, good faith, and a factual basis for seeking the documents. And I think that this section incorporates all those provisions. So to say they meant this or they meant that, or most of it, they only wanted to be able to address those derivative actions that dealt with the corporate records, I think this makes it almost a meaningless statute in today's context.
But doesn't that suggest, I mean, the fact that the legislature would have been really handing plaintiffs and shareholders' derivative actions the documents they needed in your garden variety action, especially a couple of decades ago, the financial records were the ball game. The legislature is saying you can get those unequivocally. That language says that. Doesn't that suggest the words actually do have meaning? The legislature was trying to make absolutely clear that the financial records go to that shareholder.
It may, Your Honor. I agree. But I think taking that same reasoning, they didn't mean to exclude the less common, or at least particularly at that time, other cases that could come up, other sorts of derivative actions. And again, I think you have to look at it. I think that this court's opinion in the PSE&G derivative litigation is instructive because it's basic. It's basic information that the shareholder is entitled to. And the fact that this Section 4 has no requirement that there's no wealth test, there's no requirement that he own a certain number of shares, to then say, you can get it here for a derivative suit. But to go and file a derivative suit, court doors are closed to you to even file a robust complaint unless you put up a bond for attorney's fees and costs.
The nature of the documents that are being requested are documents generally, the working group selection of counsel, the way it conducted interviews, the conflicts checks that it did, a variety of documents that don't appear to meet the plain language of books and records of account. So you've argued to read it broadly, I'd like you to contrast it with what the legislature put in section, in sentence three, where it uses the term documents, books, documents, and records, in a way that it does not in sentence one. What are we to take from that?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think it underscores the discretion of the court. I understand that this provision was added because there was a concern about requiring traveling if somebody wanted to look at documents. I would like to be able to argue that they understood that there were other things out of the state that a shareholder might be interested in looking at and bringing those in. But I acknowledge that there's an inconsistency here. But again, I don't think that you can read the inconsistency to suggest that the court wanted to narrow what a shareholder with a proper purpose could look at.
What about that language that the Chief just focused on, which is repeated in the second sentence of subsection 1, where it's referring in shorthand language to the same books, records of account, and minutes of proceedings of its shareholders? And then the next sentence says, unless otherwise provided in the bylaws, such books, records, and minutes may be kept outside of the state. Seems to me the legislature was just perhaps writing with, in a more cursory way, a reference to the same body of documents that we are focused on in both subsections here. Could that not be so?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. One thing that concerns me, Ms. Rodriguez, with the argument is that you're focused on the fact that your client is interested in perhaps bringing a shareholder derivative suit. That's the purpose you're representing. But the statute that we're being asked to interpret is a much broader one, and it seems to me that the legislature was trying to structure a regular and consistent way in which all shareholders and corporations would understand what their statutory right of inspection would entail for the documents that they have identified here. It's not limited to people whose purposes happen to coincide with a future shareholder derivative suit. So viewed in that perspective, the legislature is identifying what minimally any shareholder should have a right to inspect simply by being a shareholder of the corporation. The proper purpose, as you note, has been proven here, but interestingly, as Kane points out, under this statute, the proper purpose has to be, that burden has to be carried by the plaintiff. It's not for the shareholder, for the corporation to have to disprove a proper purpose as was so under the common law. The legislature was trying to clarify roles and minimally what everyone should be able to expect and easily obtain. Do you not agree with that interpretation?
Sure.
So viewed in that perspective, it's hard to read it as an expansive, open-ended opportunity to proceed for more general documents of a corporation as you're urging us to interpret it.
And again, I would just go back and say, I mean, you look at what shareholders are entitled to and you look at what having a certain shareholder ownership entitles any shareholder to, but I think that this provision is an attempt to balance the rights of a minority shareholder
mm-hmm.
against the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the focus has to be on the proper purpose, and that's not defined, and it's not limited. And I think that to allow the court to make a finding in its discretion as to proper purpose and then limit to a very, very narrow category of documents is internally inconsistent with the statute.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier looking toward Delaware law. Tell us how Delaware law, what language it was interpreting and how it interpreted.
Well, Delaware law talks about books and records and not books and records of account. But when Delaware uses the, when under the Delaware statute, and I acknowledge that it's different, the focus in Delaware is flipped, and I guess what I'm urging this court, the focus in Delaware and the cases that address it, including the case that I submitted, the subsequent case that I submitted, the K24 Partners versus Planetaire, that a shareholder with a proper purpose should be given access to all documents in the corporation's possession, custody, or control that are necessary to establish that proper purpose. And that's what that case stands for. And that's very broad. And I'm not necessarily urging this court that that needs to be the standard, but I think that the discretion that's built into this subsection 4 is enough so that the court can look at the universe of documents that satisfy the proper purpose and then make a determination, a balancing the minority shareholders' rights against the corporation's rights.
Anyone have other questions?
No.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, I have one last question. Disagree with the appellate division's common law analysis?
Your Honor, I'm to be quite candid, I was a little confused by it because they said we don't need to
reach it.
We don't need to reach it, but I think that Mr. Fuhrer has absolutely satisfied the common law analysis. The germane purpose is the common purpose. He acted in good faith, and the complaint is certainly a detailed. It's not simply saying they paid too much for Cubist. It's a detailed analysis of what he's claiming. So I think that he has satisfied the common law requirement.
And the trial court never reached that question. So do you feel if you don't win on the statutory analysis, you should be receiving a remand on the common law?
I think we should be entitled to prove the common law analysis. Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see anything in this statute that would suggest that the legislature intended for the common law to supersede the language of its own statute. And it could very well have done precisely what it did in the Open Public Records Act and say nothing contained in this act shall be construed as affecting in any way the common law right of access. Didn't do that. So why should we presume that the legislature intended for the common law to survive after it planted its flag in this legislative scheme?
Well, we have the court's opinion in Kane versus Merck that says that the statute was a continuation of the common law.
Well, that's different. A continuation in that written form of part of it. But for us to say that the common law is broader than the statute, like why on earth would the legislature have passed the statute?
Again, it may have been, as Justice Patterson suggested, that they were concerned with at the time a typical type of derivative suit, and weren't forward-looking to the kinds of actions that we have today, and the need for a minority shareholder to be given access early on to those documents that allow it to show that a corporation didn't act in good faith in rejecting a demand.
So there's a term, and this will be my last question. Equity follows the law. And that term means that this court should not exercise its equitable powers to subvert a piece of legislation. We should be enforcing the legislation and not using some amorphous equitable power to rid ourselves of it and therefore expand the common law at the expense of legislative policy goals. Am I off about that?
I would just end with, Your Honor, I don't think the statute and the common law are inconsistent. I think you can read them as complementing each other, and I don't think to say that there's a basis in common law asks you to ignore or set aside the statute.
And there are rights under the common law that are not necessarily addressed by the language of this statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And there's been no statement by the legislature that this act is in derogation of the common law.
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cooney.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court, my name is Gordon Cooney and I represent Merck. As a prefatory matter, I want to make three points that I think demonstrate the correctness of the very thorough and careful opinion of the appellate division in this case. First, this is fundamentally a statutory interpretation case, and the express language of the books and records statute here does not support the plaintiff's claims. If you look at the express terms of the statute, it limits small shareholders like Mr. Foyer, if they first establish a proper purpose, to obtain three things, to try to obtain three things. It's not an automatic right like the rest of the statute. It's an opportunity to persuade the court if they show a proper purpose that they're entitled to three things: record of shareholder, minutes, and books and records of account. And books and records of account has a meaning, and it relates to the core financial documents of the company. We've cited Black's Law Dictionary, the appellate division cited decisions from other jurisdictions that give that meaning, and as the court has correctly observed, those words have to be given meaning. They can't be regarded as surplusage, and the plaintiff's argument in this case is to read those words out. The second thing that's vital is to look at the fact that books and records of account is also used in subsection 1. And what is subsection 1? That's the statute that tells New Jersey corporations what documents they need to keep. It's one thing for a company to have to keep its core financial records. It's quite another thing to have a very nebulous and broad standard that would essentially require a New Jersey corporation to maintain essentially all of its records regarding any subject unrelated to financial records. And as this court knows from the De Prospero case, the entirety of the statute has to be read, all of the words in the statute must be considered, and it's plain that books and records of account must be and should be construed not just for subsection 4, but also for subsection 1, as meaning the core financial records of the company. With regard to the second sentence of the statute, I think I would just note three things. This is the statute that starts, the sentence that reads, "The court may, in its discretion, prescribe any limitations or conditions with respect to the inspection or award any other or further relief as the court may deem just and proper." I think the legislative history, as the court noted, the entire context of that sentence, as the appellate division noted, it's intended to connote that the court can put conditions, limitations, other forms of restriction in the context of a particular case. It was not intended to swallow up the rest of the rule and give the court carte blanche to order inspection unbounded by the rest of the statute and unbounded by the very clear language in the first sentence. Secondly, the books and records statute is not a litigation discovery statute. It sets forth the statutory obligations that a corporation has in terms of what documents it needs to keep, what documents it needs to provide to shareholders of certain classes as a matter of right, and then in subsection 4, what things a shareholder may go into court and ask the court to provide, but it is limited to those three very defined subjects. It is not a discovery device. And so, therefore, the question before the court here is very different from the question of what discovery a shareholder might get in the event the shareholder properly filed a derivative action that followed all the statutory requirements for a derivative action. And as the court noted, there are clear statutory prerequisites when a small shareholder like Mr. Foyer files a derivative action. And that includes, but is not limited to, the bonding requirement. But Mr. Foyer has not filed a derivative action, has not filed a bond, but the broad discovery that Mr. Foyer is seeking through this inspection request would impose some of the same burden that a litigant would face in the event that a properly filed derivative case were established and that a successful defendant could seek to recover for the discovery cost of. The third point I would make is that Mr. Foyer can't obtain these documents under a common law theory, and I think there are three main things I want to stress in that regard. First, because the books and records statute is comprehensive, we don't believe the statute should be properly construed as preserving additional common law rights. But even if some common law right remained, that wouldn't help Mr. Foyer here for two reasons. First, any common law right that remains is limited by the express language of the first sentence of subsection 4. Subsection 4 says, nothing herein contained shall impair the power of any court upon proof by a shareholder of proper purpose, irrespective of the period of time during which the shareholder shall have been a shareholder of record, and irrespective of the number of shares. And here's the important part. To compel the production for examination by such shareholder of the books and records of account, minutes, and records of a shareholder of a corporation. And so, while I believe the proper reading of the first sentence is simply that it gives the court the power under the statute to award those three categories upon proof of a proper purpose, I don't see how this statute could be read as doing anything other than, if some common law right was preserved, to preserve exactly what is said in this first sentence.
Is there anything in the legislative history that supports that interpretation? Because the language you focus on dates back to the Model Business Corporation Act from 1960, and its relevant commentary suggests that they acknowledged, with that same language you just read to us, that there is still a common law right.
Your Honor, I think I can't point to any legislative history that says, Mr. Cooney, you are right about this. I think, however, the starting point is the language of the statute, and I think what the statute says, it speaks to what has not been impaired, and I think the suggestion is the remainder has been impaired.
Well, let me ask you, following up on that, we know from the legislative history in New Jersey, that commission that I referred to earlier, this was a very well-publicized effort through the decades by the business community to refine over and over again our Corporation Business Act. And it was done publicly. There were Star Ledger articles all over the place. John McKay was prominent in that work, and he's published books on the interpretation of the same language that, as chair of that commission, the commission was recommending to the legislature and it was adopting. And in his books, he talks about the continuation of the common law. What do we make of that? Can we make anything of that?
I think you can square this, Your Honor, and it really is my third point as to why the common law doesn't assist Mr. Foyer. And the appellate division squarely addressed this on page 25 and the following pages of its opinion, and that is, Mr. Foyer would not be entitled to these documents under the common law.
Well, I think the Kane opinion makes very clear. Judge Chambers did a wonderful job in that opinion in detailing some of the history of the common law right as it existed before the Act came into being, about how limited it was and how difficult it was, and it was chancy whether a particular shareholder would get it or not. Hence, the inspection right now conferred by statute clarified a lot of things for corporations, for courts, and litigants. But the common law still is hanging out there.
And so, Your Honor, I think the best way to address this, at least from my perspective, is I think if one looks at the common law cases, and the appellate division, I thought, did a very thoughtful job of addressing this. The common law cases contemplate three different issues that are relevant. One is, what are the documents being sought? And if you look at the cases that are cited before this court for what the common law right concerned, It concerned core financial documents. Mm-hmm. It didn't concern the kinds of documents Mr. Foyer was seeking here.
So you're getting to the merits of the actual claim.
But I think what I'm also getting to, Your Honor, is what's preserved? And is the common law preserved? And I think a fair reading is what was attempted here in the statute with books and records of account is to capture that which was core to what shareholders could seek at common law.
If the legislature wasn't attempting to occupy the field here, then what on earth was it doing?
That's my belief, Your Honor. Our first argument, my belief is this statute occupies the field. It's comprehensive. There is no additional common law right.
But you were even suggesting that there, even if there were some additional common law, like what were you referring to?
What I'm saying is that the appellate division looked at this question and said, I think they came very close to saying, we don't think there's a common law right, but let's look at what the common law right was. And in this case, Mr. Foyer would not be entitled to the documents at common law. And what I'm saying is, in trying to make sense out of the statute, I think books and records of account was an attempt and fairly captured the substance of the documents that a shareholder could get upon a proper showing at common law.
So focus on the first words of the statute, because the legislature could have written a statute that said courts can compel the production for examination of books, record, etc. But instead it said nothing herein contained shall impair the power of any court. What is it referring to there?
So I think I agree that it would have been clearer had the legislature drafted the statute in the way you suggest, Your Honor. I guess what I would say, though, is at a maximum, if what's referred to here is we're going to preserve something, there's something that's not going to be impaired, the right that's not going to be impaired, you have to look at the object of the sentence, which is to compel the production for examination by such shareholder of the books and records of account, minutes and records of shareholders. So I think what the legislature is saying is that's what a shareholder gets, and whether this court looks at that and says the statute of itself occupies the field, or the court says the statute is saying nothing's impairing the right to get something, the something has to be what's at the end of the sentence, which is the right to get books and records of account, minutes and records of shareholders. So
put another way, you're saying that perhaps it preserves some part of the common law, but not with regard to the particular language that it's used.
Correct. That if at most, what's preserved at common law is the right, upon proof of a proper purpose, to get records of books and records of account, minutes records of shareholders.
All you're saying is the common law gives you the right to what's in the statute. And so we're just playing word games here. Are we not? You're basically saying the statute is the meets and bounds of what you get, and that's it.
That's correct, Your Honor. But my third point is, even if one looked at the common law and put aside this section, the statute for a second, if one looked at the common law and what the common law right concerned, and if you look at the cases that were cited, they were mostly actions by very large shareholders who had very specific allegations of misconduct, and they were seeking core financial documents that went to the valuation of their shares. And as the appellate division said on page 25 of its opinion, we are satisfied that, assuming for argument's sake, that the common law survives alongside the statutory rights, it provides no relief under the facts and circumstances of this case. And although it may be that Mr. Foyer had a proper purpose for purposes of invoking what's in the statute here, it's a very different proposition to say that what he came forward with was sufficient at common law to get even books and records of account, much less the documents he's seeking here, which go beyond books and records of account. And so I think our first and key argument is the statute really answers the question. But I think there is a second set of statutes that the court should consider here, and that is, and I don't suggest the court needs to reach this, but I think it further supports our position, and that is what we have here is an effort to end run the requirements of a derivative suit. And we noted in our papers the bond requirement, and obviously the bond requirement in part is to protect a New Jersey corporation against the expense of an invalid derivative litigation, which could certainly include expensive discovery. I would also, I think it's important to bring to the court's attention section 14A, colon 3-6.5.
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
14A, colon 3-6.5, which is entitled Dismissal of Action Upon Certain Findings. And I want to talk about it because it lays out a very detailed procedure that has to be followed in derivative cases, and that sets forth the circumstances under which discovery might be had. And I think it's important so that the court can see this. And it's also important in answering the question of, well, why don't we just follow Delaware? And so 14A, colon 3-6.5, basically says that a derivative proceeding shall be dismissed by the court on motion by the corporation if it makes a certain finding. It then says, in Section 3, if a derivative proceeding is commenced after a determination has been made rejecting a demand by a shareholder, that's where we are here, the complaint shall allege with particularity facts establishing that a majority of the board of directors or all members of a committee, which in either case determined the matter, did not consist of independent directors. I will note that all of the directors on the definition of the statute here were independent. What the statute then does in subsection 4 is to handle burden of proof, and it says in subsection 4, if the majority of directors are independent, the burden is on the plaintiff to meet the standard for bringing a derivative case. If the majority of directors are independent or are not independent, the burden is on the defendant. It then discusses a motion to dismiss the proceedings and then says this in subsection 5C. All discovery proceedings shall be stayed upon the filing by the corporation of its motion to dismiss and the filing required by this section, subsection, until the notice of entry of the order ruling on the motion. And then it says this about discovery. Notwithstanding the foregoing stay of discovery, the court on motion and after a hearing may order that specified and limited discovery be conducted if plaintiffs make a good cause showing of alleged facts which evidence a lack of independence by the person or group making the determination for the corporation or a lack of a good faith determination. So what I'm saying is, and the court will look at the statute, there is a very detailed set of requirements that a plaintiff has to satisfy in order to get the discovery that the plaintiff is trying to get here. And the plaintiff
without looking at that statute, and I have not looked at that provision, Mr. Cooney, it sounds like it might be limited to a derivative action that's based on a theory of a lack of independence of the directors. Is that so?
What it's saying, I think, Your Honor, is the plaintiff has to start with making an allegation of a lack of independence. And then the standard for granting relief, Your Honor, is not limited to that. This really is the standard, I believe.
That applies to every type of derivative action?
I believe so. It says, Your Honor, and the standard is a derivative proceeding shall be dismissed by the court on motion by the corporation if the court finds that A, The person or group specified, and meaning the board or a subcommittee of subsection 2 of this section, has determined in good faith, so good faith, after conducting a reasonable inquiry on which its conclusions are based, reasonable inquiry, that the maintenance of the derivative proceeding is not in the best interest of the corporation. And so the legislature has laid out the standard, but it's then laid out a detailed procedure for what happens next, including when, if ever, the plaintiff gets discovery and under what circumstances.
And you read that as applying even if the theory of the derivative action is entirely different from the independence issue.
I believe this is the standard for the dismissal of the derivative action. And to be clear, Your Honor, I don't think this court needs to reach the issues relating to the end run around the requirements of a derivative action, because we think the answer to the question can be gleaned from looking at the books and records statute. But the argument has been made that, well, this court should just follow New Jersey or Delaware. And I think our key points in response to that are, number one, the language of the New Jersey statute referring to books and records of account is just different than the Delaware statute. And in terms of what role or when discovery in a derivative action can be maintained, New Jersey takes a very different approach to that than Delaware. And so, again, I don't think this court needs to reach those questions, but the argument has been made based on so-called policy that the court ought to follow what's done in Delaware, and I think that would not only do injustice to the language of the books and records statute, it would do injustice to the bond requirement and the very careful discussion that the New Jersey legislature has put in place.
Does Delaware have the bond requirement?
It does not.
So Delaware has a policy of very broad discovery to give access to shareholders in all of its corporate law. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable statement, Your Honor. And I would also bring to the court's attention the Assembly Committee statement with regard to the provision of the derivative suits that I just spoke to. And it said the Senate Commerce Committee reports favorably on Assembly Bill number 3123. It goes on to say at the end of the statement, the bill is largely based on sections of the Model Business Corporation Act with substantial additions based on certain sections of the Massachusetts Business Corporation Law, and then says this, the New Jersey Corporate and Business Law Study Commission recommends enactment of this bill. The commission has indicated that the purpose of the bill is to allow corporations to avoid derivative lawsuits that impose excessive and unnecessary costs on New Jersey corporations. And so, again, I don't think this court needs to reach those questions and can base its decision by looking at the books and records statute. But the policy of the state of New Jersey, as reflected in its derivative lawsuit statutes, is different from that in Delaware.
So you're asking us to use that to inform our decision?
I think it does inform the court's decision. Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing I would simply note is, unlike Delaware, in Delaware there is no right to discovery while a motion to dismiss is pending. And so that's the Delaware approach, and Delaware has said, well, then get it beforehand. This statute that I just cited talks about while the motion to dismiss is pending, a plaintiff can come forward with good cause and get discovery. Mm-hmm. And so there are really significant differences between what Delaware has said and what the New Jersey legislature has said. There are critical differences with respect to the books and records statutes, and there are critical differences with regard to procedure in derivative cases, including with regard to when and under what circumstances a shareholder can obtain discovery.
I think we understand your point on that. Is there anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rodriguez, rebuttal.
briefly, Your Honor, on the issue of the derivative action. Again, I just want to make clear that we're not saying that discovery under the books and records statute somehow obviates the need for posting a bond. The issue is that a minority shareholder has the information that it needs to plead a robust complaint, therefore avoiding some of the issues, and that the fact that the books and records statute acknowledges that it's addressed to minority shareholders should inform the court's decision, because the derivatives, so that they can at least get to the courthouse door before they have to post the bond. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the fine presentations.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. We're going to take a very brief recess.